I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. He manages to write about a book a year, some of which make it to the big screen. But even he has doubts about his writing.
There's a lot of insecurity still when you start each day with the goal of writing 5 or 6 pages that day and making those pages part of a 500-page manuscript that people are going to buy with the expectation of being entertained.
Today, author John Grisham. This hour we'll talk with Grisham about his work for the Innocence Project and hear about his outrage over putting the wrongfully convicted in prison. We'll also talk with Grisham about his new book, Calico Joe, and his decision to dive into a new topic for him, baseball. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Novelist John Grisham has churned out a novel a year since 1988. He's written mega bestsellers that became smash movies. But believe it or not, he still has his moments of doubt. Today, a visit with John Grisham about his work for the Innocence Project and his continuing outrage over putting innocent people in prison. He's outspoken on how the system can be improved in ways that won't break the bank. He's also turned his attention to baseball, a topic he's always wanted to feast on in a book. And he's done it in Calico Joe, just out. John Grisham, welcome to Up to Date.
Happy to be here.
You're best known for fictional legal thrillers, but in 2006 you wrote your first nonfiction book, The Innocent Man. In a 2008 Time magazine interview, you said that nonfiction is too much work. I'm too lazy to do all the research. So why did you write the book?
Well, I started the book probably fairly naive about how much work was going to be involved. I'm not a journalist. Didn't really know what I was doing most of the time. But I had to kind of learn on the run. And before long, the research really piled up. And the job just got bigger and bigger. And I was surprised at how much time it did take. So when I was finally finished with it, I mean, I can write a novel in, you know, probably 6 months or so. And The Innocent Man took me 18 months.
Wow. Just because of all the work you had to do to get the story right.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you know, you're writing about real people who are alive, who did things 25 years ago, and so, some are dead, but most of them were alive, and you know, you better be accurate.
So because of all the work it took, you'll never go back to writing nonfiction again, right?
You know, I'm 57 years old. I've learned a couple of things in life, and one thing I learned is never say never. So,
yeah.
you know, who knows when I'll get another story someday, something true, or a real person, I'll get excited or fired up and do it again.
So the point of that book was what, John?
Well, it was first and foremost just a great tragic story about a guy who was a small-town sports hero who later was sent to prison and almost was executed for a murder he did not commit. And I had never thought about innocence work before. I'd never thought about those who are wrongfully convicted. And I was a criminal defense lawyer for 10 years. I never had a client who I thought was wrongfully convicted. And I sort of missed the first big wave of DNA exonerations in the early to mid-90s. I mean, I'm sure I was aware of them. But then I heard about this story, and it was just, from a storyteller's point of view, it was too good to pass up, and the researching of the book and writing the book took me into the world of wrongful convictions and innocence work, and that's why I'm still there.
So did the book precede your work on the Innocence Project?
Yes. Oh, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this book did it. Once I got into the research and writing, once I started meeting the exonerees, and once I realized how widespread the problem is, it really got under my skin, and I got to where I couldn't sleep at night thinking about all of these bad trials and bad people who had put innocent men in prison. So, you know, I'm still kind of fighting that fight.
So how widespread is the problem?
Wow, that's a great question, because there's no way to really study every inmate who claims he's innocent. And most of them make that claim at some point. The problem is just too vast to do any kind of serious study. There have been attempts. You know, we have 2.5 million people in prison right now, jail and prison, which is the highest incarceration rate in the civilized world. Nobody else even comes close to what we do. And you know, each one costs us about $40,000 a year to take care of. But we have 2.5 million people in jail or prison, and there have been studies that say, you know, that from 2 to 5% of those may really be innocent. There are some people who, some experts who claim the figure is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get into some pretty serious numbers once you get up there, and you know, you start talking to exonerees, people who've spent 10, 15, 20 years in prison for somebody else's crime, and they know other people in prison, you know, who are also innocent. And, you know, the guy I wrote about, Ron Williamson, was on death row in Oklahoma for many years, and right across the hallway was his best friend, Greg Wilhoit, and Greg was completely innocent. Both of them were exonerated, and they spent years together looking through the bars, you know, talking to each other across the hallway, two innocent men. And a lot of exonerees can tell stories like that.
You know, what strikes me, John, about these situations is society's reaction to it. I mean, these stories come up, and the newspapers, like the one I work for here in Kansas City, we all rise up, we do stories about these guys and what a injustice this has been. And then the issue seems to sort of go away. And I don't know if I really sense sort of the collective outrage among the citizenry folks sort of standing up and demanding that this kind of thing end, that puts these innocent people to prison for lifetimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not on anybody's top 10 list of hot issues. You know, we've all got the things we wake up in the morning and start thinking about: our jobs, the economy, our family, you know, the issues around us. And until you're touched by a wrongful conviction, and so few people are in the scheme of things, you don't really think about it. You know, it's just like a big civil lawsuit. You know, until you go through one, most people never experience that. So there's no public outrage. And so what we do with the Innocence Project is try to work with state legislators to clean up the laws that would prevent wrongful convictions. Almost every wrongful conviction I've seen could have been easily prevented with certain remedial procedures in the procedures. We take specific cases that we think we can win. We get DNA testing. You know, we're fighting away, and there are a lot of good innocence projects around the country. The one I'm going to visit there in Kansas City is going to be, you know, it's a really good innocence project, but it's underfunded like all the rest of them. They have a few bucks to, you know, to go fight with, but you don't think you're ever going to see the public outrage. You know, I wrote a book 2 years ago called The Confession Fiction. I wrote the book because I'm intrigued with the idea, the issue. What are we going to do in this country when we wake up one morning and we know by clear DNA proof that we've just executed the wrong person? That's what, you know, that's the case I want to, you know, what I want to talk about that, and I wrote a whole book around it. So, and I came to the conclusion that probably nothing much is going to change in certain areas. If the book takes place in Texas, I don't think it would faze anybody in Texas. Connecticut's about to outlaw the death penalty. There's a slow march towards states doing that.
Hey, but, you would favor that, John?
From a fairness point of view, because even, you know, most of my friends are in favor of the death penalty, but they're not lawyers. But I say, look, even if you favor the death penalty, you can't favor the current death penalty because there's nothing fair about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can design you one that would be fair and would work, but this thing doesn't work.
Well, we'll continue our conversation with John Grisham about his work in just a few minutes, and we'll ask him why he thinks the current death penalty doesn't work. What's so unfair about the current death penalty, and how would you change it?
Well, first of all, you got to start off with the basic notion of giving everybody a fair trial, and that does not happen very often in capital murder cases. You got court-appointed lawyers who are outgunned and outspent, so the playing field is not level from the very beginning. Almost, you know, the percentages are astonishing. If you're a black guy and you kill a white person, you're much likelier to be prosecuted for capital murder than if you're a white person and you kill a black person. Hmm. And those numbers have been around forever. It is arbitrarily enforced. You can do one crime in Kansas, step across the river into Missouri, do the same crime, and not get the death penalty.
Yeah.
Two guys can walk in a store, one shoots a gun, the other one doesn't. The one who doesn't have the gun gets a death penalty. You know, there's so many inequities and inequalities in the current system.
And so you would change it how?
Well, you start out with a fair trial.
Yeah.
Have a fair trial. Well, first of all, take it away from the local prosecutor. Do what the federal government does in federal death penalty cases. Give it to the attorney general. Let him study the case. Let him present it to a review committee who will look at the evidence to see if it appears to be a death penalty case.
Mm-hmm.
That way you get it away from the local prosecutor, away from local politics and all that. Then you give each side the same amount of money and lawyers, and you go try the case, change the venue, try it somewhere where it's fair with two elite teams of lawyers. And again, this saves money. It may sound expensive. Have a judge who does nothing but death penalty cases, who knows the law, knows how to try one. So you provide a trial that is as fair as possible. If you do that, 90% of these guys are going to be convicted anyway because they're guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But you've cleaned up the system. You've made it fair. The appeals will go much faster because there are fewer mistakes made at trial. But you have given the defendant a fair trial.
And what's holding us back from instituting just what you're talking about?
The prosecutor, local prosecutors, will never let go of a case. It's too big of a deal for them. They want to try a big case. They get tired of trying, you know, shoplifters and meth cookers. they want, you know, the big sensational capital murder case. And a lot of them are elected, and they run for office. And these things are wonderful, you know, publicity tools. And you will never get the case. If you file that bill in the Missouri State Legislature or the Mississippi State Legislature, your prosecutors would descend on the state capitol, and not a single person would vote for it.
Yeah, yeah. We're visiting with novelist John Grisham. He'll be in town on Wednesday on behalf of the Midwest Innocence Project. You know, DNA exonerations make the news when, you know, they overturn a conviction, but it's not the only cause of wrongful convictions. What are some of the other reasons? And I'm thinking of, you know, eyewitness misidentification, John, other things like that.
Well, the one you just mentioned is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable for a lot of reasons, and that's a big one. Junk science, allowing bogus experts to testify in trials about arson, about bite marks, about footprint marks, about fabric and fiber and things like that they just, you know, it's just junk. In the Ron Williamson case, it was hair analysis, which is notoriously unreliable and has been banned in most courts. One of my favorites is it's just so bogus. It's the jailhouse snitch.
I just was going to bring that one up.
Yeah,
yeah, you bet.
The police can't solve the crime, but they have a good, trusty snitch in jail. So they tell him what's coming, and they bring the defendant in, and they put him in jail for a couple days with the snitch. And then the snitch pops out one day and says, okay, he confessed to me. Let's cut a deal. And they'll give the snitch a deal so he won't serve any time for his drug charge. And the suspect probably forgets about the snitch until 4 months later when he walks in a courtroom, and there's a snitch with a coat and tie on, haircut, and says, oh, yeah, he confessed and gave me all the details.
Mm.
Well, the police gave the details to the snitch, and judges allow this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think sometimes, John, that people don't realize just how much pressure there is on police departments to keep up with what they call their clearance rates of, you know, solving these crimes and getting things off the books and moving on to the next one. There's a lot of pressure on these guys.
Tremendous pressure. In small towns where the crimes are, you know, really shake a community, or, you know, even in big cities where the press coverage is relentless, there's enormous pressure on the police. And that's why they, they make a lot of mistakes. I mean, if they another cause for wrongful convictions is or false confessions. At the Innocence Project, we have about 280 DNA exonerations now in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
25% of those involve people who confessed. And juries will, you and I, nobody believes you would confess to a murder if you didn't really do it.
Right.
Well, people confess all the time. And they do that after they've been interrogated for 10, 15 hours,
nonstop,
threatened with death, threatened with everything, threatened with maybe, I don't think they beat them anymore. The only way to stop that is to videotape the interrogations. And most good police departments do that now. I mean, most of you good, honest police departments turn the camera on when the interrogation starts. And so the interrogators are bound by certain rules. But as I said, almost every wrongful conviction that I've seen in the past 6 or 7 years or studied could have been prevented if the proper laws and procedures were in place.
You know, still, though, there are those who think that it's better to err on the side of caution and maybe keep a possibly innocent person in jail rather than risk setting a guilty person free. How do you respond to that, John Grisham?
Oh, I'd rather err on the side of innocence. I think I'd rather let a guilty person go free than execute an innocent one.
Mm-hmm.
I live in fear of when we're going to execute an innocent person in our rush to fight crime and all this kind of stuff. You know, we pass more and more death penalty laws every year. Just we got to be tough because the politicians got to be tough, and we're going to finally do it one of these days. And then I don't know what we're going to do then.
Yeah. Again, we're visiting with novelist John Grisham. What did the legal world think about you before this book, The Innocent Man? And did attorneys, did they change their tune when you started advocating for the Innocence Project?
Oh, I'm not in touch with that many lawyers. Lawyers are a big portion of my reading public. They enjoy the books. I get criticized by lawyers all the time because of my portrayals of lawyers are not always flattering. And I tell lawyers I'm just reflecting, the reality here.
Mm-hmm.
The response from the few lawyers I've talked to from Innocent Man have been from criminal defense lawyers who are out in the trenches every day, and they know, what goes on, and they know how accurate the book is.
We'll return to our conversation with John Grisham in just a few minutes. Your new book, John, Calico Joe, just came out last week, and it's not a legal thriller. You've wanted to write a book about baseball for a very long time, haven't you?
Oh, 20 years.
Hmm.
Since I started publishing, yeah.
Because why?
Well, it's my favorite sport.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it as a child. It was the first sport I played. Still my favorite. At the college level, at the professional level, and really at the little league level. But I love baseball books, baseball movies, and for many years have wanted to write one.
And you've been a coach, too, a little league coach, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I wasn't much of a coach. My overall record was a losing record. I coached my son from the age of 7 to the age of 15.
Mm-hmm.
And we won one championship in, 8 years. But I sure had a lot of fun doing that.
You're a St. Louis Cardinals fan, but you grew up in the South. So how did you make the connection to St. Louis?
Well, listen, back then in the rural South, Arkansas and Mississippi, it was all Cardinals from the big chunk of the Midwest. I've talked to people in Florida who grew up with Harry Carey and Jack Buck every night. That was the closest team. My grandfather was a huge Cardinal fan because of Dizzy Dean, who was an Arkansas farm boy.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a huge Cardinal fan. He thought Stan Musial was the greatest person to ever live. And that was my DNA, okay? I just grew up with it.
Yeah. Well, the book is about the Cubs and the Mets in 1973. Why those two teams?
Unlike most Cardinal fans, I did not grow up hating the Cubs. I've always liked the Cubs. I loved Ernie Banks and Ron Santo and the teams in the late 60s and early 70s. And I said it at Wrigley because I just you know, I kind of feel sorry for the Cubs fans, and I would love to see a World Series at Wrigley Field. You know, it's just one of the last great old ballparks in the country. I use 1973 because my narrator goes back and forth between now and 30 years ago, and it just kind of whittled it down over a period of years thinking about the story and settled on the Cubs.
You know, you wrote a piece for the New York Times a couple of years ago in which you talked about sort of the different jobs you've held over the years. You've worked construction crews in the Mississippi summer, 100-degree heat, but then the asphalt making it a whole lot hotter than that. You've crawled under houses working for a plumbing company, looking for the pipes and all this stuff. But you wrote this about writing. You said, I never worked so hard in my life, nor imagined that writing could be such an effort. It was more difficult than laying asphalt and at times more frustrating than selling underwear, which you used to do at Sears. But it paid off, you write, and it certainly did. Eventually, I was able to leave the law and quit politics. Writing's still the most difficult job I've ever had, but it's worth it. Why is writing so darn difficult for you?
Well, I'm not sure it's easy for anybody.
Yeah, I was going to say.
There's a lot of insecurity still when you start each day. The goal of writing 5 or 6 pages that day and making those pages part of a 500-page manuscript that people are going to buy with the expectation of being entertained, of being suspended in another world where there's a lot of suspense, a lot of action, and it can get pretty intimidating at times. Because I've been lucky, I have a lot of people who are going to read the next book, and so I want it to be what they expect it to be. So. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pressure, and some days are good, some days are not. Some days you really have to work at one sentence for 15 minutes. And the next day it's easy.
Well, you're making me feel better here, because you're saying that even after all these years, all these mega bestsellers, you still feel the pressure to write. You still feel insecure, and it's still darn hard work.
Oh yeah, I can't imagine it ever gets easy. I publish rapidly. Okay, I can write a legal thriller in 6 or 8 months. I can write a kid's book in 3 or 4 months. So I have a hard time working slow, and I have a lot of stories I want to write. But when I'm actually writing and putting one word after the other, there are times when that's very difficult, because once I finish a sentence, I read the sentence out loud and then read it with the sentence before it and think about the sentence after it to make sure there's a certain rhythm and flow to the words. And that's the process that can be very frustrating at times.
Well, you've clearly learned something, because your first novel, A Time to Kill, you've written it took you 3 years to get that done, oftentimes getting up at 5 a.m. in order to work on the book. But now you're saying you can get a legal thriller out in 6 or 8 months. What have you learned about the whole process of writing that's enabled you to pick up the pace the way you have?
Well, it took 3 years to write A Time to Kill and 2 years to write The Firm back-to-back. But I was also pretty busy as a small-town lawyer trying to, support a family. I was a member of the state legislature in Mississippi. So I had a few irons in the fire, and I didn't have a lot of time to write. That's so different now, because I have all the time in the world to write. And I like to publish a book, once a year, at least once a year. And to do that, I've got to get up in the morning, and get to the desk by about 7, 7:30, and work pretty hard until about noon for 6 months. And when you do that, the pages kind of pile up and the book comes together. But I just have a lot more time to do it now.
And you want to publish a book a year because why? It's important to you because why?
First and foremost, I have a lot of books I want to write, a lot of legal issues I want to explore, other courtroom dramas I want to bring to the readers. There's just a lot of ideas, and as long as the ideas are flowing, I want to keep writing. I keep saying, I'll take a year off and go do something, but I don't know what that's going to be. Mm-hmm. I haven't found that yet. if I do, I'll take a year off and go do it. And also, I have a, again, I have a lot of very, very loyal fans who expect that book a year.
Yeah.
And it'd be, it would really be tough if they didn't get it, you know.
We're visiting with novelist John Grisham. But what issues do you still want to explore in the legal world, John? What's out there that still has you wanting to get to them?
Oh, a lot of issues. Guantanamo and torture and arresting U.S. citizens and without giving them their full rights. Prosecutorial misconduct, abuse by the government. Legal extortion by big corporations who sue smaller corporations, healthy corporations, in an effort just to grind them through the process and make them go broke. I want to write a big, thick novel about medical malpractice and doctors and insurance companies and patients and all, but I've been trying to do that for a long time, and I can't get the story right.
In just a few minutes, I'll ask John Grisham about writing for the reader or for the movie theater. Many of your books have been turned into movies, you know, The Firm, A Time to Kill, Runaway Jury, The Client, and others. When you write your books, do you compose them thinking that they might be turned into movies or not?
Well, no, I mean, I wrote the first two books in a certain way, and both of them became films. I didn't know if I was even going to finish those books or they'd get them published, so I can't say I had my eye on the movies. You know, but after a number of books, I know what's going to happen. I publish one, and we're going to get a lot of phone calls from a lot of people in the business, and they're going to want to talk about a movie, and, you know, those phone calls tend to go away, and then if someone's serious, they'll hang around, and we eventually maybe sign a deal. It's become very difficult to get a movie made in the last 10 years. So I've only had a couple, and they're all for sale. And there are three or four in various stages of production right now. So they might get made. I don't know. It's just a different world now. We all like a good movie, and I would love to see all of my books adapted into good movies.
And that becomes a goal after a while.
It's not a goal. It's just something I would like to see. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. It's not gonna upset me or ruin my life if it doesn't happen. It's all gravy. By the time you publish the hardback and the paperback here, so many other things that happen with the book, the foreign sales, the movies, that's just gravy.
But it must be a thrill to see a book made into a film. Is it?
Oh, tremendous thrill.
Yeah.
A big thrill. And every time it happens, I watch the movie and I get a kick out of it when I hear one of the actors use some dialogue that I wrote and they took from the book. Yeah, it's a big thrill.
Do you still wake up at 7:30 in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning to do your writing?
Yeah, I get up at about 6 every morning out of habit and drink the coffee for a long time, watch some television with my wife, early news stuff. And then about 7:30, go over to the office and lock the door and get to work.
Do you still spend most of your time at home in Oxford, Mississippi, or are you elsewhere now?
We've been in Charlottesville, Virginia for the past 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to Oxford tomorrow. We get back and forth all the time. We have a lot of friends there, a lot of family there. But we're spending more and more time in Virginia.
You're still associated, though, with Mississippi.
Oh, big time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the Innocence Project at the University of Mississippi. My son went to law school there and finished a couple of years ago. We have a lot of ties there.
After all these years and all these books, you still have other books you want to do. Do you have anything else you want to do career-wise besides writing books?
You know, it's funny you asked that. I was talking to my wife over the weekend, and we were just on the porch reading Saturday afternoon. It was a beautiful day. And I made the comment to her, at this point in my life, there's no burning ambition to do anything. And I can't decide if that's a bad thing or a good thing. You know, I've been lucky. I've had great success in writing books, and, you know, I'm still living a dream. I'm the luckiest guy I know. But something tells me that, you know, you don't need to be at a point in your life where you don't have the desire to go do something, go accomplish something else. Right now, I just don't have that, and I don't know where it's going to come from.
Well, John Grisham, it's been a thrill for us to have you here. Thanks for taking the time, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Wednesday when you're in town for the Midwest Innocence Project.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Enjoyed it.